That brings you back.
Three. The Supreme Court ruling today that the president can have more control over a controversial financial regulatory agency. A 5-4 Supreme Court ruling that California law for challenging the structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The Obama administration, in its face complaint, President Trump and other Republican lawmakers, President Trump will have the power to fire the CFPB's director. The Supreme Court rules, arguing the structure created by Congress. The separation of power, Fox's Jared Halpern in Washington. Iran has issued an arrest warrant and asked Interpol for help in detaining President Trump and dozens of others. Police carried out the American drone strike that killed a top Iranian general in Baghdad earlier this year.
Please join me in saying the Anabakoa. Anabakoa, Gedula Chemincha, Tati, Seruha, Aleph Gimel Yutat Tati, Kabel Rinat, Amcha Sagdenu, Kaharedu, No Ra, Kufre Shayan, Sintet Nun, Nagibor, Dorshe Yehudha, Kevavat, Shamrem, Nun Gimel Dalet, Yutav Shin, Barhem Taharem, Rachame Sidkatha, Tamid Gamlem, Betet Resh, Saditav Gimel, Chasin Kadosh, Perov Tufa, Nael Adata, Het Kufet, Tet Anayim, Yachid Geyeh, Lamcha Penei, Zofre Kedushata, Yud Gimel Lamed, He Zayin Kuf, Shavatenu Kabel, Ushma Tziakatenu, Yodeya Talumo, Shin Kufav, Tadiyuta. In the eighth verse of the Anabakoa, we say in a whisper. The class today is continuing in our basic classes. You'll find the handout on the Revealed Wisdom Matrix in row 8. The first column on the left, basic class 8, Tzedakah and Truma. When you open up the landing page, it's the first link, I believe. And we'll start with the L'shem Yehud. L'shem Yehud, Kudsha Barichu, Vishkite, Bidkilu, Urshimu, Udkilu, Udkilu, Urshimu. L'yachda, L'shem, Yudhei, Bavavhei. V'yehuda, Shalim, B'shem, Kol Yisrael. Limud Torah Mitzvah. Lasok Torah Mitzvah. Vayhino amadunai Eloheinu aleinu ma'asei yadeinu karenei aleinu ma'asei yadeinu karenei. Tonight or this afternoon, we are going to learn why you get a speeding ticket or a parking ticket or have a fender bender accident or even why you have such expensive medical insurance payments and deductibles. It will also explain why the mortgage interest rate was above the generational average of 1% to 3% for so many years. Also, why do you need to pay 30% to 40% of your income to housing costs instead of the more traditional 20% to 25%? Would anybody like to tell me what is tzedakah? Would anybody like to tell me what is truma? Let us start with one statement that you have never heard from a rabbi asking for a donation until now. And it is important that you realize that I'm not a rabbi, so the confusions can still remain if you so choose. Truma is tithing. That is nice. But can someone tell me what is tithing? In the Western world, tithing is considered charity. Here is what Wikipedia says about tithing. A tithe is a one-tenth part of something, paid as a contribution to a religious organization, or compulsory tax to government. Today, tithes are normally voluntary and paid in cash, checks, or stocks, sometimes donating your car. Whereas historically, tithes were required and paid in kind, such as agricultural products. Several European countries operate a formal process linked to the tax system, allowing some churches to assess tithes. The Hebrew word that translates as tithing is truma, spelled taf, resh, vav, mem, he. It comes from the shoresh taf, resh, mem. This shoresh translates as contribution, or to contribute, to raise funds, to donate, to lift. The word truma is usually translated as a contribution or an offering. There is a parasha that has as its name truma. It's the seventh parasha of the Sefer Shemot, or the Book of Exodus. It is very similar to the parasha Vayechel that is translated as gathered. Moses gathered contribution towards the building of the tabernacle. Do you see the connection? The word tzedakah is very different. It is not a contribution. We will look into tzedakah below and after we go deeper into truma. Traditional Jewish law and practice has included various forms of tithing since ancient times. Orthodox Jews commonly practice ma'aser kesafim, tithing 10% of their income to charity. In modern Israel, Jews continue to follow the laws of agricultural tithing, ma'aser rishon, trumat ma'aser, and ma'aser sheni. In Christianity, some interpretations of biblical teachings conclude that although tithing was practiced extensively in the Old Testament, it was never practiced or taught within the first century church. Instead, the New Testament scriptures are seen as teaching the concept of a free will offerings as a means of supporting the church. Also, some of the earliest groups sold everything they had and held the proceeds in common to be used for the furtherance of the gospel. Further, the book of Acts contained the account of a man and a wife, Ananias and Sapphira, who were living in one of these groups. They sold a piece of property and donated only part of the selling price to the church. They claimed to have given the whole amount and immediately fell down and died when confronted by the Apostle Peter over their dishonesty. I apologize for bringing the New Testament into our discussion, yet I feel it is important to get a sense of how the meanings of the concepts of tithing and charity have changed. Please note that the Hebrew terms used by Wikipedia in the paragraph above are translated in a corrupted way, and this will be clarified below. The source of tithing is from the Parsha of Vayetze in the book of Bereshit, or Genesis. In this parasha, Jacob has the famous dream of the ladder going from earth to heaven. Upon awakening, he vows to God to give God 10% of everything he receives, if God will fulfill his promise. Has God ever not fulfilled his promises? Some people say not yet. Some people do not even understand the question. Does God fulfill his promises? If the answer is yes, why do I need to give or contribute or donate or tithe 10% away? Wikipedia teaches the following information. The tithe is specifically mentioned in the book of Leviticus, in Numbers, and in Deuteronomy. The tithing system was organized in a three-year cycle, corresponding to the Shemitah cycle. Every year, Ikurim, Truma, Ma'aser Rishon, and Trumat Ma'aser were separated from the grain, the wine, and the oil. As regards other fruit and produce, the biblical requirement to tithe is a source of debate. Unlike other offerings which were restricted to consumption within the tabernacle, the yearly tithe to the Levites could be consumed anywhere. On years 1, 2, 4, and 5 of the Shemitah cycle, God commanded the children of Israel to take a second tithe that was to be brought to the place of the temple. The owner of the produce was to separate and bring one-tenth of his finished produce to the old city of Jerusalem after separating Truma and the first tithe. But if the family lived too far from Jerusalem, the tithe could be redeemed upon coins. Then the Bible required the owner of the redeemed coins to spend the tithe to buy whatever you like: cattle, sheep, wine, or other fermented drink, or anything you wish. Implicit in the commandment was an obligation to spend the coins on items meant for human consumption. The third year was called the year of tithing, in which the Israelites set aside one-tenth of the increase of the land. They were to give this tithe to the Levites, to the strangers, to the orphans, and to the widows. These tithes were in reality more like taxes for the people of Israel, and were mandatory, not optional giving. This tithe was distributed locally within the gates to support the Levites and assist the poor. The Levites, also known as the tribe of Levi, were descendants of the son of Jacob, Levi. They were assistants to the Aaronic priests, who were the children of Aaron, and they were a subset of the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi did not own or inherit a territorial patrimony in the land of Israel. Their function in society was that of temple functionaries, teachers, and trusted civil servants who supervised the weights and scales and witnessed agreements. The goods donated from the other Israeli tribes were their source of sustenance. They received from all of Israel a tithe of food or livestock for support, and in turn would set aside a tenth portion of that for the Aaronic priests in Jerusalem. An additional tithe mentioned in the book of Leviticus is the cattle tithe, which is to be sacrificed as a korban, an offering at the temple in Jerusalem. Now that we have heard the corrupted understanding of the concept of tithing, let us learn what the Kabbalah teaches the spiritual law is all about. There are 10 sefirot, of which the last or the bottom sefirot, which is called Malchut, has no light of its own. These are spiritual laws or systems. It means that 10% of what you receive has no light within it for you. Either you voluntarily donate it away, or it will be taxed away from you by the universe. By the way, the spiritual system returns the voluntary donations to you along with an increased amount. This is why all of those questions I asked at the beginning of the class happen. This is why you have large, unexpected auto repair bills, and you do not expect them. This is why you get a parking ticket today and not yesterday. The same for a speeding ticket, and why we live in a generation that has high housing costs relative to the historical norm. We have run out of time to make our donations of tithing voluntarily. Of course, you have the choice to start now and save yourself from these expenses in the future. The spiritual law is 10% of what you receive. Spiritual law is 10% of what you receive does not belong to you. It is given to you to share. When you share the 10%, it is returned to you plus an additional amount. When you do not share, the universe will tax it away from you, since it belongs not to you. This is the meaning of the spiritual phrase, no light for you. What does this apply to? It applies to everything. Without exception, whatever you receive, money, time, gifts, things, food, and most troublesome, it applies to children. Jacob had 12 sons. He lost one for 22 years, which is Joseph. Then the Levites became donated to God and working in the temple, which is why they did not receive any part of the land in Israel. It is as if they were not inheritors of the land, since that land, the kingdom, has no light for them. How does this work with children today? Have you heard about the increase in autistic children? Perhaps, and I stress perhaps, because there are many reincarnation aspects. These children are coming to parents who did not tithe their children in earlier lifetimes. It also applies to children who die in miscarriage or from cancer and from other plagues. Please do not spread this information to other people. It can cause tremendous unnecessary pain. I also hope that I am not causing pain to others in this class now. My mother and one of my daughters have had two miscarriages each. I am sensitive to the pain that this can cause, and I apologize to anyone who is hurt by this information and ask your forgiveness. In any event, this is my truth, or another way of saying it is the truth for me. One further thought with respect to Jacob and Levi. As we spoke above, you tithe 10%, having to do with Malchut having no life of its own. Jacob had 12 sons. When the tithing of animals took place in biblical times, the understanding was the first one in is the last one out. Based on this understanding, they would funnel, for lack of a better term, they would funnel the lambs or the goats or whatever animal into the holding pen. They would do that not in a group, but one at a time. And then when they would take it out of the holding pen, they did so by counting 1 to 10. And it came out through a chute, a narrower place, a gate, where the animals could not bunch up. So they came out one at a time. And every 10th animal was marked or put aside and became the property of the temple. When it came to Jacob's sons, he had 12 sons. The last one was Benjamin, who was born at the same moment that Rachel died. If you count the delivery pattern of his 12 sons, counting backwards from Benjamin, who represents the last or the Malchut, the 10th son is Levi. This is why Levi was donated to the temple. This is why he worked in the temple. Now let us move on to the concept of tzedakah and the difference between tzedakah and terumah. Over the centuries since the destruction of the temple, the rabbis stopped using the term terumah, and they started to use the terms ma'aser, which means a tenth or a tenth part. As the different forms of Judaism developed into the Reform and the Conservative and the Reconstruction, as well as others, the rabbis started to use the term tzedakah and constantly remind us of a verse in Proverbs, which is very true. Tzedakah saves you from death. The prophet Jeremiah, who had the job of forecasting the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem prior to the destruction of the first temple, would pray to Hashem for a truly poor person. Why did he do that? And what is a truly poor person? All living human beings are poor people because we all lack something. Be it health or wealth, joy, happiness, or people who are close to us who have left. We lack something. Whatever it is, we all lack something, and that makes us a poor person. Yet not every poor person is a truly poor person. A poor person, according to Jeremiah, is someone who has such certainty in the Creator, in Hashem, that he is used by the Creator to approach certain people and ask for tzedakah. Who are these certain people? They are people who have been judged with harsh judgment. As a form of mercy, Hashem will send a truly poor person to give them an opportunity to go outside of their comfort zone and thus earn some mercy and have the harsh judgment decree of death removed. Let's understand this. And this is an unwritten comment, but I probably have covered it, but I just don't think it's as clear. Someone does a sin. And during the nights, that person has heard the decree of the courts of the Bet Din, giving them a harsh judgment. Perhaps it's loss of their money. Perhaps it's loss of a child, God forbid. Perhaps it's a bad crop. Perhaps it's a death of themselves, God forbid. Perhaps it's the destruction by fire of their dwelling. Whatever the harsh decree is, sometimes, and I emphasize the word sometimes, Hashem sends a truly poor person to the door. To the door of the person, meaning his house, but it can also be just that you meet on the street. The true poor person does not care. He's not invested consciously in whether you give him a donation or not. What he's invested in is Hashem. And so he has been sent to you to ring your doorbell, to talk to you, to stand outside a restaurant and ask you to contribute. He has come to you as Hashem's mercy. What form does the mercy take? The mercy takes the form of asking you for tzedakah. If you make that contribution of tzedakah at that moment, the decree is vacated. Continuing to read. A truly poor person knows that Hashem will provide for them. A truly poor person knows that when they approach someone to ask for tzedakah, they are being sent by the Creator to give that person an opportunity to save his life or to remove the decree. A truly poor person does not care. He's not invested in whether you make the donation to him or not. He knows that someone will make a donation and give charity so that he will have some place to sleep that night and something to eat when he is hungry. Whatever he lacks, he knows that Hashem will provide it, so he does what Hashem directs him to do. He asks for tzedakah, not caring if someone reaches into their pocket or not. Tzedakah is a Hebrew word that gets translated as charity. It is in addition to the truma. It does not replace the truma. The halakha, or the law, is that the sum of the tithing and the tzedakah cannot exceed 20 to 26% of your income or your assets. This is because once someone realizes that there is a harsh judgment decree that includes death, he is willing to give everything away to stay alive. Yet that makes him a burden on society. This is not what Hashem wants. Hashem wants you to go out of your comfort zone so that you can earn the merit to have the decree rescinded and receive this kind of miracle. When you go out of your comfort zone, Hashem goes outside of the natural law, which what is the definition of a miracle? What does it mean that Hashem goes outside of natural law? It means he rescinds the decree. But only if you go outside of your comfort zone. Then the natural law, which is the decree, you sinned, you were judged in the upper court, the decree was issued. That's natural law. It's not natural law only in the physical world. It also includes the spiritual. And this natural law can be rescinded because you go out of your comfort zone. Is it out of your comfort zone to give a homeless person a dollar? Probably not. But if you're also homeless and you're also hungry and you give away your last dollar, that's going out of your comfort zone. And that will start the beginning of your upward climb of materiality, material wealth. We can discuss going out of your comfort zone for a lot of different aspects. But if you contemplate it, if you think about it, your comfort zone is what's normal for you. There are some people who are constantly afraid. It's part of their astrological influences. It's always understandable. It's a natural effect. When you face that fear and go against it, make the action that goes against your fear. An example of this is the binding of Isaac. Abraham is told to sacrifice his son. And he lived in a time when children were sacrificed by their parents. But Abraham knew that Hashem would not require a sacrifice of Isaac. Even so, it was against Abraham's nature to take his son and sacrifice him. It was a test. Hashem tested Abraham to see what he would do. He knew the outcome. He knew he wouldn't kill him. Yet, Abraham, on a conscious level, did not know that he was not supposed to sacrifice him. But on an unconscious level, he did know that. And Abraham went against his nature, which was not to kill his son, and started to sacrifice Isaac by binding him on the altar. That is going against your comfort zone. When someone embarrasses you, that is going against your comfort zone because it makes you feel lousy. It embarrasses you. You feel horrible. But what do you do? Do you defend yourself? Do you attack the other person? We're seeing a lot of that in our political environment today in America. But if you stand silent It's against your comfort zone. I'm continuing to read. Tzedakah has a shoresh, tzedek. Tzedek means three things: justice, righteousness, and the planet Jupiter. One can begin to get a true sense of the power of the Hebrew language from looking at these two Hebrew words. Tzedakah, or an act of justice and righteousness that goes outside of your comfort zone, is different than the act of tithing, or truma, which is recognizing the lack of light for you in the Malchut Sefirah. Over the centuries, the rabbis who were asking for support for their synagogues and other people would tell people, give the money, give this money, and it is tzedakah, since they themselves benefited and are usually not a truly poor person. Supporting your place of prayer is a normal need of the human animal. It is truma. It is not tzedakah. How can I tell if a request is from a truly poor person? Does he ask for a specific amount? He is not a truly poor person. If you give a small amount of money, like a penny, in the hands of a homeless person, does he say thank you and walk away? Or does he start screaming insults and curse words at you? The person who curses and insults you is not a truly poor person. After you have found a truly poor person, run after him to give him more and more until your life is saved or you reach the maximum of 26%. In a personal experience, I was on my travels from Los Angeles to Atlanta. Didn't know it was Atlanta that I was headed for. I would move from one city to the next every 2 to 3 months, teaching people in that city what I'm teaching you now, the Kabbalah principles. And I was driving to a restaurant, and I was buying vegetarian materials, vegetarian food from a fast food restaurant, because there was no kosher restaurants in the area that I was in, and I didn't have access to a kitchen where I was staying. And I'm driving along, and there's nobody on this. It's really a parking lot, and there's nobody in the parking lot. And all of a sudden, on my way to the restaurant, there's a person who's got a sign out asking for, doesn't say tzedakah, doesn't say, I think the sign said, we'll work for food. We've all seen these people on the highways or off the highways. But it didn't make sense because this is the middle of a parking lot. There was no reason. There was not heavy traffic. Why was he standing there with that sign? But that didn't occur to me. What occurred to me is to give this person some money. So I stopped my car, I rolled down my window, and I handed him a dollar. And I drove on, because I was hungry. And then I thought, I had the thought, that's a truly poor person. So I turned around immediately, less than 2 minutes, looking for the person because I wanted to give him more money. And he wasn't there. He had disappeared. Did he walk away? Did someone pick him up in those 2 minutes? I can't answer that question. But I did know that I didn't have the opportunity to give him more money. And maybe it was okay just to give him the dollar because I was driving, it was unusual, and I stopped. And maybe that was sufficient for Hashem. Remember, the movie is playing out. But if you go out of your comfort zone, you are doing binding by striking. You are changing your movie. Continuing. Here is another example of the power of the Hebrew language. The word ani, meaning I, is spelled Aleph Nun Yud. When permutated into Aleph Yud Nun, it means nothingness. I, or ego, is actually nothingness and is what separates you from me, and me from you, and both of us from Hashem. Now the word ani, spelled ayin nun yud, means a poor person and can be permutated into ayin yud nun, which means ayin, the organ that we see with. This teaches us that to discern a truly poor person, one must utilize our eyes to discern the truth about each request for charity or donation. Just you can see that permutating a Hebrew word, a Kabbalistic tool which teaches us aspects of the relationships with words and essences. When we permute our names and utilize the gematria of the letters of our names, we can learn about our own character and personality traits, as well as our personal tikkun issues. This is a project that is next on the building of the Hashem website. I am approaching you each today as a truly poor person and asking that you commit to a monthly amount of tzedakah. And I do not use this word lightly or incorrectly. In order to manifest this project to become automated so that anyone can type in their name and have all of the permutations and gematriot and the meanings returned to them on the webpage. To facilitate this, I ask that each of you consider the method you would like to utilize to make this tzedakot, the plural of tzedakah. You can mail me a check or provide a credit card number. You can send money through PayPal. It does not matter to me whether you give me any of this money or you donate any of this time, of your time, to help in this process, because there are many things, many aspects, doesn't need to be a computer coder to do this. There are many aspects that we need to develop a database that has the appropriate names, the appropriate understandings of the letters and the words. As I said, it does not matter to me whether you do this or not. I know this will manifest. When it will manifest is up to Hashem. Who or whom will make these donations . It does not matter to me. I know they will happen when the time is right. I'm continuing to read a little bit further down, not two, three lines. Here is one more point about tithing the Hebrew language and kashrut, which we will discuss in a few weeks. The word aser, you shall tithe, can be split into two words, ayin and shin resh. The letter word ayin has a gematria of 70. The word sar, shin resh, means an angelic chieftain. Thus, aser translates and reads the 70 angelic chieftains, the 70 angels. The Torah tells the children of Israel that they are to receive the land as a tithing result, as explained now. This comes to tell us that you will take the ma'aser from them. One-tenth of them is seven. But on account of this, you are obligated to separate one-tenth of your produce. It is important when eating produce that comes from the land of Israel to ensure that the ma'aser was separated correctly. The effect of not doing this will forfeit your right to the land. We will discuss this during our class on what is kosher. Here is another thought-provoking teaching from mystical paths. The Roman Emperor Tornos Rufus asked Rabbi Akiva, if Hashem truly loves the poor, why does he not provide them with parnassah? To save us from Gehinom, replied Rabbi Akiva. Gehinom is hell. The emperor countered, on the contrary, giving tzedakah should send you there. Suppose a king imprisons his servant and commands that he not be served food or drink. If someone would disregard the king's bidding and give the prisoner food, wouldn't he get angry? My commentary on this story. This is a perfect place to test yourself regarding your human values. Is the Roman emperor correct? Is Rabbi Akiva correct? What do you think is the correct thing to do? You also have an opportunity to honestly see how easy it is to use logic to prove something is wrong when it is right. Please contemplate this statement. Rabbi Akiva explained, imagine a king imprisons his own son and commands that no food or drink be given to him. But despite his command, someone brings the prince some sustenance. When the king hears about this, wouldn't he send the man a gift? Similarly, we are Hashem's children. Here is an opportunity for you to determine the difference in your own life between truma and tzedakah. Please read the following paragraph, which comes from an email dealing with the energy of chesed. Money. Excuse me. Money makes the world go round. Have you ever approached an ani, a poor person, or a collector who's collecting money for others? Before the davening, and given him a dollar before he approaches you. Better question may be, why on earth would you do that? Why not wait for him to come to you? If he does, fine. And if not, then you've successfully dodged another one, right? The Gemara in Bava Basra tells us that Rabbi Elazar used to give a pruta before he would daven. The Gemara cites what we read in Tehillim. Ani betzedek, echese bonecha. The Kav Hayashar explains that the relationship between tzedakah and tefillah is like that of seasoning and food. Just as the spices bring out the flavor of the food, so too does tzedakah bring out the tremendous power of tefillah. The Ispitzer tells us that the Rambam in Hilchot Matnot Anayim says that one of the most sublime levels of tzedakah is to give before the poor man asks. Therefore, it is very effective to voluntarily give tzedakah before a person davens, prays. And hopefully the Abishter will act measure for measure and answer our tefillot, our prayers, before we ask. Just as the Pasuk says, V'hoyo derem yichra'u v'ani einyeh. It will be before they call, I will answer. The next time you see a person collecting in a shul or anywhere else, give him the money first. He's going to catch you anyway. In the story that I just read you, was that tzedakah or was that terumah? If you give prior to being asked, is it tzedakah or is it terumah? Here's a commentary by the Rambam, Maimonides, on the epitome of logic and rational thought as portrayed within the Jewish religion. Actually, Maimonides was a Kabbalist, and his writings are not taught this way today. Levels of charity. The Rambam writes, we are obligated to fill the needs of every poor person according to his previous state. If he does not want to accept tzedakah, we need to find some other means, such as representing it as a gift or a loan. There are 8 levels in giving tzedakah. In descending order, they are: 1. Giving a man a job so that he is not reliant on others. 2. Giving without knowing who is the recipient, and in such a way that the receiver does not know who is the giver. 3. Giving in such a way that only the receiver knows who the giver is. 4. Giving in such a way that only the giver himself knows to whom he is giving. And I'm stopping with an aside to say, why am I using the word giving and not sharing? You share without an agenda. You share without any expectation of receiving something in return. When you give, you are giving with an agenda. You are attaching a consciousness of expecting something in return. Truma, you're receiving something. You're giving, expecting something. You're expecting to get that 10% that you're giving back. That's at a minimum. There are many other thoughts involved. As for tzedakah, tzedakah is only when you go out of your comfort zone. But you truly know when you go out of your comfort zone that you're going to have a miracle in your life. So you're giving the tzedakah. You're not sharing the tzedakah. That's true for both tzedakah and truma. The fifth item, giving to the poor before being asked. Sixth, giving after being asked. Seven, giving less than one is able to, yet giving that with a smile. And the eighth level is giving in a cheerless manner. Again, I ask, does each one of these apply to tithing and or to tzedakah? Here are some final thoughts, not on tzedakah and tithing, but on the shoresh for these subjects. He has told you, man, what is good. What does Hashem require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? A prophecy from Micah. What is the meaning of the above verse from the Tanakh? The Chafetz Chaim teaches that the world is built upon a foundation of chesed. All Jews are spiritual people and are linked to each other by their ability to give and their occasional need to take a dynamic that weaves the Jewish people together in a fabric of compassion. Chesed in and of itself is obviously a concept of an immeasurable intrinsic value. Nevertheless, the words of the prophet Micah teach us that chesed alone is not the ultimate goal for a Jew. There is an added element, ahavat chesed, the love of chesed that takes this already powerful vehicle, serving Hashem, and fuels its launch into the heavens. The Chofetz Chaim explains the difference between performing chesed and loving chesed. One can discern this difference for oneself by examining the thoughts and attitudes that accompany an act of chesed. For instance, when the charity collector knocks on the door, a person may experience a momentary sinking feeling. He may think, I haven't got time for this, or I haven't got the money to give away. He knows he would much prefer the collector bypass his house. The contribution he gives will be chesed, but there is no ahavat chesed, no love of chesed in this act. Contrast this with another scenario. There is a family that advertises itself in the local Jewish newspaper as the place for out-of-town charity collectors to come for free room and board. This family considers it a triumph when they hear that knock on the door. They feel just as enthusiastic about the time and money they put into this venture as they might feel about putting the same time and money into a family vacation. In another example, a man commutes from a suburb each day to a major city, an hour and a half away. He constantly asks those with relatives or business in that city, do you need a ride? Do you need anything delivered? He looks for his chesed customers as aggressively as he would for paying customers. The simplest way to identify the feeling of ahavat chesed is to think about the way one feels expending time and effort on one's own family. One wants his son's bar mitzvah suit to be the very best he can afford, a perfect fit, of good quality and comfortable. One takes pride in seeing his son wear the suit. The parent doesn't feel that he has lost money in this endeavor. He feels only a sense of gratitude and joy at having been able to share. This is the attitude Hashem wants each Jew to develop toward chesed. Performing this mitzvah with love and enthusiasm provides it with its ultimate power, far beyond the already potent force of chesed, performed out of a sense of obligation. Here is another teaching about this very important subject: how to love tzedakah, opportunities, and how to love chesed. A person with enough self-discipline and persistence can force himself to perform an act of chesed, even if he has no real desire to do it. A more difficult task is to force oneself to love chesed when the feeling doesn't seem to be present in one's heart. This is a far greater challenge, but it cannot be an impossibility, simply because the Torah never commands the impossible. Therefore, one must assume that within each Jew dwells the capacity to love chesed, even if a person must dig deeply within himself to search for this emotion. Such a search conducted by a simple Jew provided a lifetime of inspiration for the Hasidic Rebbe, Rabbi Bunim of Fishka. Rabbi Bunim spent his early years as a businessman. In his constant business travels, he used every interaction as a means to bring Jews closer to Hashem. On one such journey, he stopped at an inn on a cold, stormy night. The Jewish innkeeper found in Rabbi Bunim a sympathetic ear for his tale of a failing business. The peasants no longer came to him. Vats of liquor sat untouched in the basement, and the landlord was growing impatient for the rent. Rabbi Bunim spoke with the man for a while and then sat down to learn. In the middle of the night, there was a loud knock on the door. A traveler, drenched and freezing, begged the innkeeper to admit him, even though he had no money with which to pay. The innkeeper sighed at his misfortune. He finally had a customer, but even this wouldn't bring him any money. Nevertheless, he helped the traveler. He let him in. He gave him a change of clothing and a room for the night. The traveler, however, was still shivering. "Could you bring me some vodka, please?" he asked. "I don't have any money, but I'm so cold." The innkeeper went to the basement to tap into his vodka supply for the first time in weeks, once again for no profit. He didn't notice that Rabbi Bunim was there watching him. What the rabbi saw, however, struck him so powerfully that he told of the scene for the rest of his life. The innkeeper poured a cup of vodka, then shook his head firmly and smashed the cup to the floor. Once, twice, three times, four times, he repeated this procedure. Oblivious to the sin of wastefulness he was committing, finally, upon pouring the fifth cup, he happily proclaimed, "Now," and brought the vodka to his desk, to his guest. Rabbi Bunim asked the innkeeper to explain this strange behavior. The explanation was touchingly simple. He couldn't serve the guest a drink. He had poured with disappointment and resentment in his heart. He knew he had been handed a golden mitzvah, a chance to revive a shivering, hungry, poor man, yet his financial worries were clouding his ability to appreciate this gift. He tried and tried again until he reached the vein of Ahavat Chesed that was within him. Then, satisfied that he was doing his act of kindness with a full heart, he brought the man his drink. I apologize for running over. I hope you found it meaningful. Are there any questions? I'm going to unmute your phones.
Right there.
Everyone can now be heard, so if you have a question, please go forward. We have two more classes tonight, one at 4:30 West Coast time and one at 7 West Coast time. The 4:30 class is the deep Zohar class. The 7 o'clock class is The Writings of the Irie. And tomorrow at 11 West Coast time, we will have a class continuing our study of the Sefer Joshua. Are there any questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
When you're giving like a certain amount, I don't know how to phrase this. You're not giving like one large amount, which you're saying is your terumah, but it's like you're giving it to different places, but that's still what's considered your terumah, and then everything after that would be tzedakah. Is that correct?
Not quite.
Okay.
First off, I didn't mention, but it's important that I do mention it. It's better to give smaller amounts more often than one large amount.
Okay.
So if you're giving different amounts or the same amount to different organizations or to different places, each of those is truma. And as long as
right.
the total adds up to the 10%, you're better off.
Okay, that was my question. You answered it.
Okay, but you also asked about the rest. You said the rest is tzedakah, and that is not
right,
true.
Right, yeah. Oh, okay.
Tzedakah requires that the truly poor person approaches you. Because
okay.
it is Hashem sending the truly poor person to you.
Okay.
Because the decree is there. It's not like you can give more money to than the tithing, and then you can hold that tzedakah is going to hold you over and avoid any decree. It's the other way around. The decree happens first, and then sometimes, but not every time, Hashem says, this person is worthy of an opportunity to give tzedakah. So he will send you a truly poor person.
Oh. Okay.
Finding a truly poor person is very difficult. In fact, the prophet Jeremiah never found a truly poor person. He kept praying to Hashem to send him a truly poor person, because all of the Jeremiah's prophecies generally speak of the destruction of the temple. And he was tired of it. He didn't want the temple destroyed. He knew what we would lose. We don't know what we lost, but he knew.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
he kept praying for a truly poor person, but the Jewish people, the children of Israel, did not merit having that opportunity. May you all merit to have a truly poor person approach you. I hope it's now clear.
Yes, it is.
Are there any other questions? Have a beautiful afternoon. I hope to see you in the later classes. Shalom Gadol.
Shalom Gadol. Thank you.
Shalom to all.